So what we've been doing in this part of the class for the last few weeks is talking about the essentials of meditation. And where I've been starting, where I want to keep on going back to and exploring more and more, is this whole question of imagining a new consciousness. So for you, those of you who've been coming, you'll be very aware of this. But really this is the whole crux of meditation. The whole crux of life, really, is can one imagine a new kind of consciousness? A greater consciousness than your own just now. That's what I keep on wanting to come back to, because that's the whole purpose of meditation, is to foster, to discover, to develop, however, whatever metaphor you want to use. I like discover. A new kind of consciousness that goes beyond your everyday consciousness. And it's very analogous to the poet sitting down to write a poem. They know that what they're hoping to do as they write, or a filmmaker starts to make the film, or theatre director starts to direct the play, what you're hoping as you do it is that something that you hadn't thought about, something that goes beyond your usual sense of yourself, comes in. So whoever writes the poem, it's never the person who just sits down with a cup of tea at their laptop, whoever paints the picture. What really does it is a new consciousness that can arise in at its best, at its deepest, artistic experience and so on. Yeah? So I've been really stressing that we're trying to imagine a new kind of consciousness. And I've been using this, you know, story of my niece Alex, who... You know, when I said to her I didn't expect to have little girls in my life, she said, I'm not little. So from her point of view, the main thing about that statement, I didn't expect to have little girls in my life, is an insult of the word little, you know, where she was four, you know, she's well and truly grown up by then. And I can't explain to her that adults have a different consciousness to children. When you're an adult, you have to, don't you, if you're a parent, you have to manage children's consciousness. Like, you know, for instance, at a certain time, you have to stop playing games where you squeal and run about. You know you have to sort of calm everything down, and you instinctively quieten your voice and you say, OK, now we're going to have a bath time. You know what will happen if their consciousness keeps arising in this squealing and runabout kind of way. You know that they're not going to be able to sleep, and you know that that's going to be a nightmare the next morning. So an adult consciousness manages that, doesn't it? Assuming you've got one at that moment. Adult consciousness is much more rare than it looks, I think. So do you see what I mean? That when you're a child, you don't realise. I remember my mother saying to me, she used to always say, up the wooden stairs, because we had stairs and they were wood. Up the wooden hill, is what she said. Okay, up the wooden hill. And I used to feel so disappointed and feel so cheated, particularly on summer evenings when it's still light. And she'd say, OK, up the wooden hill, my brothers and I, my sister and I, would all sort of troop up. And I remember feeling sort of, this is just not fair. You know, there's no need for me to go up the wooden hill. I've still got lots to do. You know, you just have no consciousness as a child of what adult consciousness is like. You can't imagine, can you, a different kind of consciousness. In which they know that they need to get you to bed now, because otherwise you're going to be a nightmare in the morning. Yeah? Which means that they'll get... If you're not sure about this, if you think actually child consciousness is the same, try and convince a tired child they are tired. You know, they can have these huge panda eyes. You say, are you tired? No. It's like an absolute insult to say to a child that they're tired at any time. They will refuse. Yeah? So to see that... As a child, you can't imagine an adult consciousness. And an adult can't explain that they've got an adult consciousness. It's one of the, I don't know, laws of life. You can't explain to a child that I have a different perception. You see that it's a different perception. It's the same kind of consciousness, but it's got a different range, different perspective. Or you could say simply, it's got more perspective. A child thinks, no, I'm feeling fine and awake just now. Why do I need to go to bed? A responsible adult knows that if I don't keep this perspective of getting to bed now, I know what will happen in the future. So what a greater consciousness is, really, is a greater perspective on your own life, on the life of around you. A greater consciousness involves an awareness of the consequences of your action. So, you know, when you're a teenager, you enjoy getting drunk, but you've got a very limited awareness of the consequences of that, the next morning even. Hopefully, as you get older, you start to, you can see it gets rarer, doesn't it? You start to have more of an adult consciousness. So meditation, what Buddhism's trying to do, is try to say that there are higher, deeper, richer levels of consciousness that can keep arising from us. Just as our adult consciousness is larger, has more perspective than our child consciousness. It's not quite as simple as that, because you need to keep something of your child consciousness. If you lose that sort of innocence, that purity, that's a bad thing. So it's actually more, the more you think about it, it's more subtle, but just to keep it simple. So when you sit down to meditate, what you're really doing is saying that there could be a new kind of consciousness. And what we've been exploring on this seminar is the kind of effort you need to make, that I need to make, to bring about a new kind of consciousness. Yeah? So that's what we've been applying. And we were talking last week about the dhyanas, which is usually talked about as supraconscious states. So they're states of being and consciousness that transcend your ordinary waking consciousness. At the deepest, to a very profound degree indeed, in which your sense of time disappears, your sense of yourself seems to disappear. You feel rapturously content and happy. It's very, very difficult to describe it, but consciousness can arise, can flourish in new ways, in deeper, in higher ways, throughout the dhyanas, and it can go beyond that into insights into nature, into understanding of the nature of reality. So what we've been exploring is that we're trying to imagine another consciousness. As soon as you come to this centre, what you're basically doing is saying, I want to imagine a new kind of consciousness. As soon as you sit down to meditate, you're doing that. You're trying to cultivate a new kind of consciousness. A consciousness that is more positive, that's not locked in negativity particularly. So that's what we were just exploring earlier on in the seminar, that so often consciousness doesn't arise in a new way because we're so locked into negativities, so locked into self-absorption and stories and antipathies and polarities and just the sort of busyness and dross of modern life. So very often our consciousness is constrained, is constricted into this sort of painful me that we so often experience. And often the reason people come to this centre is because they have some sense that this constricted, painful consciousness that I experience on the tube, going to work, getting up in the morning, there must be more to life than that. And what meditation is about, what Buddhism is about, is discovering that more to life. Yeah. But you see that what we need to do is imagine another kind of consciousness. Now, you can... It's not that that other kind of consciousness is alien to you. It's distinct from you. I've been saying it's distinct from your normal consciousness, but not separate from it. So today, for instance... I've been listening to someone doing a reading of Wordsworth's prelude, the two-part prelude. All of you will know it. anyway, fantastic poem. What you get in that prelude? In the prelude, he talks about his childhood, and what he's saying is really, really clear as day. If you listen to the poem or read the poem, is that as a child, he experienced intimations of immortality, intimations of a new kind of consciousness. In the two-part prelude, he says, when I look back to my earliest childhood days, I see myself as a little boy running around in the Lake District, and I seem to feel this other being, this other consciousness that was much bigger than mine. Yeah? And in that poem, he gives you one and another example, skating at night when he was a child and shouting and his voice resounding off the hills, stealing a boat and rowing across a lake at the middle of the night as a little boy. You know, so exciting. And as he's rowing, and it's so quiet, and the night is full of stars, and he's got this lovely kind of naughty pleasure of having nicked this boat. It doesn't say nicked in the poem. But it's lovely. He's rowing, and it's this lovely quiet night, and he describes the oars in the water and the stars. And as he's rowing, of course, as you're rowing, you're looking back way, aren't you? And as he rows, it's got this scene, the horizon. Behind that horizon, this mountain starts to rear up, as if the mountain is leaning over towards him. And the more he rows, the bigger this mountain gets. And he experienced that as like the arising of a kind of God, fully conscious of him, that as he rowed away, it got bigger and went towards him. And he said in the poem that, you know, it filled him with this incredible sense of a larger consciousness, which for him is nature. Yeah, for him is nature. And he experienced nature as a child so rapturously that his sense of himself seemed to fall apart. So what he did is he rowed back quickly. The mountain receded. Rowed back quickly to moor the boat up. But he says in the poem that it lasted for days. This sense of being in a universe, being in a world that's alive, like a huge consciousness, which his consciousness was articulated with, and that he felt his consciousness was thin to it as a child. One of the tragedies of Wordsworth's life is he lost that more and more. He became, frankly, a boring old fart, as it's so easy to do. He became, you know, a sort of very standard sort of Victorian man. And he was very aware that he lost this rapturous contact with life, that consciousness thickened, his self-consciousness, me, Wordsworth, important person, thickened, and the nature of reality was pushed away. So you might have had intimations of immortality as a child, a sense as a child that there is something much, much more to life. And often you realise that the adults don't understand it, or perhaps they don't experience it. You remember that day on your Saturday as a child. It would go on forever, a summer Saturday like tonight, go on forever. And you'd be playing until you couldn't see the ball anymore, until your mother calling you in for tea again and again. And you just want, well, all the colours flicker, don't they, as twilight comes, and consciousness and world seem to flicker together in that strange liminal place between day and night. So some people experience that very, very much as a child. The intimations of, I mean, Wordsworth calls it intimations of immortality, by which he doesn't mean you live forever. He means intimations of some great new consciousness that is quite more than... Interesting, it's never God. To think of it as God is just to make it small. Buddhism doesn't believe in any kind of God, but it does believe that consciousness can evolve at different levels to the point that it feels so vast, you can't imagine it being you at all. As I said, the primary symptom of a greater consciousness is this greater perspective. So some people experience bits of it in childhood. You can experience it in trauma. So it's not uncommon to experience a greater consciousness in the worst moments. I remember when my father died. It all seemed very normal to me, and sort of too normal. I remember thinking, shouldn't I be much more upset than I am? I wondered whether I might be Frankenstein at one point, because I didn't seem to have any emotions, and didn't seem to have the right emotions. But I seemed to live in a different kind of consciousness for a while, in which I felt a sort of quiet blissfulness and ease that just seemed almost bad-mannered, given the fact that my father had died, but everything seemed touched by a greater consciousness just for a while. I could hardly remember my life and what I did here in London. I could even hardly remember teaching here at the centre. I seemed to live in a very quiet, different place where everything shone just very slightly. So sometimes you can experience this greater consciousness in trauma. Sometimes you can experience it through works of art. Again and again through time, people have experienced listening to a piece of music, or looking at a painting, Wordsworth, as I say, experienced it through nature. He says in one letter that when he was about 10, he went walking to school, his experience of nature was so vivid that he had to grasp onto a wall and sort of push himself into the wall to feel his body, to feel that he was separate to nature. He felt that he was going to disappear into nature, into this vast consciousness. So yes, you can experience it through childhood, you can experience it through a trauma, you can experience it through art, you can experience it sometimes in communication. It's always there. Another kind of consciousness is always in potential. Yeah. So do you see that what we're always trying to do is imagine a new kind of consciousness? And one of the classic ways in which Buddhism tries to do that, in fact all religions have tried to do that, is through evoking it ritually, is to create a ritual. And a ritual is just like a theatre space. Theatre arises out of ritual. What you do in theatre is you say, it's as if. Yeah. So you go and see Romeo and Juliet, and you know full well that they're acting, and you know they're not dead at the end. When they get up at the end, they think, oh my gosh, they're not dead. You know, you know full well they're dead. You even, if you've been to it like I have a few times, you know exactly what's going to happen. But yet you can put all that aside and be completely moved by the plight of 16-year-old lovers. You can be deeply moved, even if you know that Romeo is actually gay, and you know she's definitely not his type. You're absolutely moved by their plight. And a new kind of consciousness can arise, can't it? You know that time when sometimes you come out of a film and you want to be quiet, or at the end of the film you want to sit and let the credits roll, and you just want to stay there in that dark. Other people crunch over the popcorn, and you just want to stay there, listening to the music, staying in that mood. And you want your friend that you've been with not to say anything. You want to wait. And if they do say anything, you want to go... But you don't do that, because if you did that, it would push that consciousness away. Yeah, you want to go out into the streets on a night like this where it's slightly rainy and there's puddles, and you want the atmosphere of that new consciousness that's arisen from the film to illuminate life a little bit, to give it a sort of richer meaning. Yeah? So there are all these ways, and ritual, what we're going to be doing tonight, is an ancient way of doing that. It's a sort of pre-theatrical way. What a ritual is saying, okay, we're going to imagine that we're going to do this ritual, and as we do this ritual is going to create a new kind of consciousness. We don't know how, because if you're not careful, if you try and create a new kind of consciousness, even if you try and find one, you're looking in a particular place, or it's in this or this. Actually, often a new kind of consciousness arises quite unexpectedly. A friend of mine, I talked about it before, was just looking out of a window and seeing a plane through the window. Suddenly, a new kind of consciousness arose. It often comes in unexpectedly. So if you try to develop it too much, you've got an idea about where it's going to be. So in a ritual, you're just saying, I actually don't know what I'm doing in a ritual. I have no idea. Alex, my niece, who's now 7, I ask her questions and she says, I have no idea. So when you're doing a ritual, you have no idea what you're doing in that sense. You have no idea. The only thing you know in a Buddhist ritual is you're not worshipping a god, and you're not worshipping this particular statue on the shrine here. This figure stands for, or rather sits for, consciousness completely arisen. You know, this new kind of consciousness constantly re-arising at greater and greater levels. Yeah, that's why the figure is gold. Gold always represents a consciousness, a state, and consciousness is clumsy, but a state of being and acting which is quite beyond your normal sense, including beyond your sense of a difference between you and the world. You and world become one. When a new consciousness arises, self dies into life. That's how I've been putting it. Self dies into life. So this figure represents self continually dying into life, so that when you looked at a sunset, all there'd be would be the colours of the sunset. When you talked to a friend, all there'd be would be the moment of the friendship. When you watched the breath, all there'd be would be the moment of the breath. Self dying into life again and again and again, just rapturously dying into life. So what we're going to be doing today is doing in the second half, and I will say a little bit in the second half, is doing this ritual, which will feel a bit foreign for some of you, especially if you're new to ritual. But hey, it's foreign to all of us, whether we've been doing it for a long time. We have no idea what we're doing, because we don't actually know what this figure represents. Yes, it's the Buddha, and we could say something about his life story, but we don't even know what enlightenment means. I don't know what it means, because I've not experienced it. I've got some sense of it, an intuitive sense, and I even intuitively sense when I'm kind of aligning myself with it in my very small way. But I actually don't know what it is. So none of us know what we're doing. We have no idea. So we're just going to do these verses in call and response. We're going to chant a mantra. We're going to make offerings to the shrine. We're going to burn some incense or light a candle to the shrine. And not because we're worshipping a figure, not because we're worshipping, there's no gods or even there's no gods or God. We're trying to act as if by doing this spell, by casting this spell, a new kind of consciousness will arise in us. And if it arises in me, it's more likely to arise in you. The more of us it will arise in, it rises together. You can feel it. I can feel it in the room when a new consciousness arises between us, because it goes beyond us. So in the second half, that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing this ritual. I'll say a bit more about it in the second half, not very much, because there's a particular point to this ritual tonight, but I just want to establish ritual, really. And the main thing I want to emphasise is we don't know what we're doing. I'm leading it, but I don't know what I'm doing. I kind of know the Buddha's forms, and I can pull it off. And at times I feel in alignment with it, and I sort of do know what I'm doing, but I couldn't explain it. Somebody once said to me, "Why do you bow?" And I thought, I have no idea. I just kind of want to. So we're going to do things, and I'm going to tell you what to do, because there's a sort of form to it, like there's a form to so many things. And I want us to try and see if by doing a ritual, we can cast a spell in the room in which a new consciousness can arise. Yeah. Sounds spooky, but life is spooky. I mean, think about it. Just for a moment. Think, actually, I don't really understand what's going on, so that's really spooky. We don't know nout. Yeah? So we're going to do a ritual because we don't know anything. Yeah? So that's perfectly straightforward. So we're going to have a cup of tea now. At least we know our way around a cup of tea. And if you're lucky, you'll get a biscuit. And then after the tea break, we'll come in. I'll say a little bit more about the ritual, then we'll do the ritual.